You've tuned in to the PDU Podcast, a production of EMS Radio. The PDU Podcast brings together industry experts and seasoned professionals to discuss topics in the assessment and management of the pediatric patient in the out-of-hospital environment. You can interact with us at pd-u.com, on Twitter at PDU, email us at podcast@pd-u.com, or call us at 716-245-5336. I'm gonna hold on to you as long as I can. I'm gonna hold on to you as long as I can. Hello and welcome to the inaugural episode of the Pediatric University Podcast, or more simply put, PDU. My name is Kyle David Bates. I'm going to be your host. And I kind of came up with this idea after a recent pediatric call that I had where I had a young child who was unconscious. Everyone was thinking that he was a seizure and everyone was panicked. And I'm looking at this kid going, I don't think it's a seizure. It seems more like he's unconscious. And we kind of found out he fell off the top of the slide and really racked his marbles pretty good. And people were panicking before I got there. And I started to say, wait a minute. You know, we got to look at these kids. We got to look at what we're doing. And I start to think about, why do people always panic when they see kids? Because, you know, I really have to tell you, I personally don't think kids are all that scary. And I'm hoping that through this biweekly podcast, we're going to start to bring topics of pediatric education to the EMS pre-hospital world. This, let you guys also know that, you know, with some knowledge, you may not be as scared to take care of these kids as you are now. So we're going to kind of dispel some of those. So here to help me today is Ms. Charlotte Crawford. Charlotte, how are you?
I'm doing great, Kyle. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thank you, Charlotte. Why don't you go ahead and tell our new listeners a little bit about yourself?
Okay. First of all, I've been a nurse for 30 years, worked various areas with the last 20 plus being in the emergency room, and I'm a paramedic, so I work the field as well.
And you're also a mother and,
oh,
I will
yes.
say, a grandmother.
Oh, no. Yes. Yes, I am.
But I think that helps out a little bit, too, in terms of assessment of children, because you have experience with it.
True.
You always know the people who don't have kids because they carry the kid straight out in front of them like it's a ticking time bomb.
Or under their arm like a sack of potatoes.
I do that now. Next, also help me, you know, with us is Mr. Scott Keir from the First Few Moments podcast. Scott, how are you?
Hi, Kyle. How's it going?
Fantastic. Why don't you tell our folks a little bit about you?
Well, I've been a paramedic for the last 10 years, EMT for about 17, working in a busy urban system in the lovely state of Massachusetts.
Great. Any kids, Scott?
None that I know of.
None that you know of. Okay, great. Well, that's good then. We're going to get a little impression from that side of things too. And finally, the last but not least, to help me initiate this podcast is Dr. Lou Romig. Dr. Lou, how are you?
I'm doing excellent. How's everybody doing today, Kyle?
Oh, we are doing great. A little chilly up here in Buffalo where you're down there in a nice warm Miami.
Yeah, ain't it a shame.
Dr. Lou, why don't you go ahead and tell our listeners a little bit about yourself.
Oh, goodness. I have been a kid lover for years on end and have put that into a career in pediatric emergency medicine for over 20 years now. I work at Miami Children's Hospital in the emergency department and have been an EMS groupie since the old days of Johnny and Roy in emergency and have been working with EMS providers for over 20 years. I'm the pediatric medical director for NAEMT and the national international medical director for their emergency pediatric care corps.
Now, that's a new program that's just coming out, isn't it?
Well, no, actually, we've been around for a while. We changed the name about 3 or 4 years ago, but with the revision that we've been completing just recently, it seems like an entirely new course and is really exciting, very dynamic, and I think has a lot to contribute.
I tell you, my son's on some of the slides because I put together the slides for you guys. So I inserted little pictures of my son holding on those.
And a fine looker he is.
He's got mom's looks.
Of course, I think all kids are beautiful.
Oh, they're absolutely great. And that kind of is a great segue into what we're going to talk about. Is I go to a lot of these conferences. I go and do a lot of speaking. And I do have a couple of pediatric sessions that I do. And I always like to start out with, you know, you're dispatched to the two-month-old not breathing. And you always hear this big gasp go out through the audience. And it's like, so what do you do? And I hear the phrase, we're going to leave. We're going to call ALS. We're going to pretend we're not going. Because everyone panics when they hear this come out. And,
you know, I kind of understand why, because there's not a lot of pediatric education out there. EMTs get very little. Paramedics get even less. PALS is probably really the only exposure that they get to the pediatric patient with that. So it's great. You know, PALS is wonderful in terms of dead kids in essence that, you know, they know what to do when a child's in cardiac arrest. But do they really know how to assess? And I think that's where a lot of the issues come up in terms of EMS and pediatrics is we don't really know how to assess kids. You know, we're all familiar with the adult patient. We're all familiar with the geriatric patient. The 80-year-old patient who's not breathing, we have no problems with. Nah, that's an easy one. I can take care of that. But the 8-month-old, we panic. And I always look at it saying that the 80-year-old, I'm a little bit more nervous about because of their past medical history, those 80 years of what have they been doing to their body. And so our group today, I want to discuss kind of why do we have this feeling that kids are scary?
I think a lot of it is you're dealing with something that people view as being unnatural. It's expected that an 80-year-old be at the tail end of their life when you're confronted with a 2-month-old, 2-year-old, a child. They're supposed to have another whole bunch of years ahead of them. And it's just I don't think people view it as a natural progression that we kind of encounter every day.
Well, I think the other thing is that children change over relatively short periods of time. You know, once you get to be an adult, you'll go through certain stages, but they're not so much physiological stages. They're stages of career development, relationships, whereas children's physiology actually changes. And then so does their cognitive capabilities. So their ability to cooperate with you and to communicate with you as a patient and give you additional information is changing constantly. So it's like you're facing a new animal with every single age group. And I've been known to say in the past that taking care of a kid is as much dependent on listening with your eyes as listening with your ears, because what you see is so much important as important as what you're hearing in the way of history. You know, a 2-month-old has very little history. So all you've got to go on is what you're seeing right in front of you.
Do you think providers are afraid to touch these kids, especially if they don't have kids? You know, they seem to panic when it comes to these children, and they don't understand why.
Well, I think anybody who hasn't been around kids, who particularly is confronted with a small child, gets this feeling of, oh, I'm ham-handed and inexperienced, and I might do something to harm this little creature. And, you know, fortunately, kids are much, much tougher than what people give them credit for. They bounce instead of breaking generally, and for the most part, they get better in spite of you rather than because of you. So I think it takes a little bit of time and experience to get that confidence that you're not going to hurt them just if you hold them wrong. And I think that's one of the biggest stumbling blocks is if you don't have that experience, then you seem to think that this is something that's completely new to your experience and your training. And because of the relative infrequency of encountering a pediatric patient, and that generally is around 6 to 10% of all EMS calls, that doesn't give you much time to practice.
You know, Doc, I agree with you on that one. I think a lot of the problem we have is we don't deal with a lot of children. I mean, everybody's comfortable dealing with the older people because that's probably 70% of our calls. And if we're only doing 6 to 10% with pediatrics, and that's a wide range for pediatrics, there is a terrible discomfort level. And you worry because when a kid is sick, they're usually really, really sick.
But, you know, the thing is, I always look at it is, okay, if the kid's really, really sick, a lot of times, you know, you're dealing with, you know, dehydration, you're dealing with respiratory issues along those lines, you know, and everyone's like, well, they can't tell you what's wrong. They drool, they babble incoherently, and they wear diapers. But I'll tell you, I go to some of these long care nursing homes, and I have patients, 80, 90-year-old patients, that, for lack of a better sense, are the exact same way, but they've got the history that makes me worry. They've got the cardiac history, the respiratory history, and I mean, it's a heart failure, is it pneumonia? Is it heart failure with pneumonia? Is it COPD? And, you know, trying to figure out what's going on, where I think the younger kids are, for me, I find a little bit easier, a little bit more enjoyable to take care of because they don't always have that background, that history. I mean, Dr. Lou, am I you're thinking that, or
you're right on the money. When I have to see an adult patient, and that happens not only when I'm out on a disaster deployment, but a surprising number of times in my pediatric ER, because adults figure sometimes that any ER is as good as any other ER for taking care of whoever. But I feel exactly the same way. You know, I've got an adult in front of me, and I've got somebody with 70 years of past history and 70 years worth of things that could be influencing their condition right now, and that's scary to me, because there is that much underground. It's like an iceberg. There's that much more underground that I have to worry about. So I'm with you. It's the adults with that long history that really give me the creeps. And, you know, the kids, you talk about them not being able to tell you. They're telling you a whole heck of a lot. It's just sometimes it's not with words.
I definitely agree. I mean, you know, just the other day, went to a car accident, girl with back pain. She comes walking up to me. She's, you know, dad's bringing her over to me, and she's smiling. And my little trick is to play with the kid. You know, she was 5 years old, so she's old enough to follow directions and stuff like this. And I had her giggling and laughing right there. That told me a lot.
Absolutely. I carry little wind-up toys and little things that engage the kids at different levels depending on their developmental status. And I'll tell you what, I'd rather have somebody steal my stethoscope than steal my toys, because I can get a lot more information on a physical exam with one of my toys than I can with, you know, something that's not as much of a multitasker like a stethoscope.
How do you use those toys to help you do the assessment?
Oh, my goodness. You know, they're hard to find these days, but it seems like they're coming back just a little bit. But if you can find a little toy that fits in your pocket that is an animal in particular, or sometimes, you know, a popular cartoon character, but something that kids of different ages are going to be able to identify with, particularly if, like an animal, it makes a noise. If it's a colorful little thing, so you can get the attraction of the color. If it also has some kind of emotion component that also attracts attention, you can have kids name the color. You can have kids name whatever the animal or the figure is. If it's an animal, you can have them make the sound that the animal makes. You can put it down on the ground and ask them to go and pick the animal up. And if they go over, they walk over, crawl over, whatever, pick the animal up, then you're judging their proximal motor strength, their distal motor strength, their motor coordination, hand-eye coordination, ability to obey commands. It's just, there are tons and tons of things that you can get as information on your physical assessment just by having the child interact with the toy. You can even test for meningitis by getting them to follow the toy with their eyes and with their neck. You know, put it down, and my little wind-up ducky, I tell them that the ducky is going to kiss their belly button, and when the ducky goes over their belly button, the first thing that they do is they look straight down at the belly button. And if they can do that without any pain or stiffness, then the chances are they don't have meningitis. It's amazing. It's really amazing.
I mean, those are the great things. But I think to do that, you have to kind of understand the cognitive development of children. And I think that's where we're lacking. I teach another pediatric program that's out there. And I always do the very first lecture, which is child development, because of my background in education. And it's always been one thing I enjoy doing. And I think that that's one of the issues that we don't spend enough time on is how kids develop and knowing how to assess them. So what, you know, what kids would that work on, such as a 2-month-old? That probably wouldn't work.
No, 2-month-old is not going to do much for, except that possibly they would react to a noise that would be close to their ear. They might respond a little bit to motion. But as far as being able to attend to a toy, being able to focus on that toy, that's probably going to be about at least a 3 or 4 month old. But you're only going to expect them to be looking at the toy and not interacting with the toy so much. But by the time they get to be 8 months to a year or so, then they should be reaching out for that toy and, you know, taking a more active interface with that toy. And then as they get older and older, then they can talk to you, they can recognize a character, they can make a noise. It's a smooth integration of those cognitive capabilities. But there are ages where you can say, okay, this is what I'm going to expect in a normal child as far as their ability to interact with their environment. And it's that interaction with the environment that is really what tells you how their body is compensating for whatever the medical or traumatic insult is. And, you know, I think many people nowadays are familiar with the pediatric assessment triangle that was first put out in the PEP course, of which I was one of the original authors, and is continuing in use. And the PEP course has been incorporated into a lot of other resources, including NAEMT's emergency pediatric care course, where we've really made that the centerpiece of our assessment, and we're very heavily assessment driven. And as you said, the first thing that we do, the first lecture that we give, is a lecture on assessment. And it includes those developmental kind of pearls. And, you know, I'm the first one to admit that developmental stuff can be dry and really boring, but there's just a few key things that you need to be able to remember. And, you know, it's not like you have to do a Denver developmental test, which it's fine if you don't even know what that is, because I wish I didn't know what it was.
I think, you know, and I think that's the good part with that. I mean, the PAT is such a useful tool. And I tell everyone, I say, if there's anything you get out of any of the courses, it's how to use that tool. And I've used that. And, you know, it comes in handy. I'll never remember. Buffalo Flair comes running out with the limp, you know, the limp 2-year-old. And I'm like, okay, that's not right. Okay, but not a problem. Okay, abnormal appearance. Look at his breathing. And there was no retractions, no flaring, no abnormal audible sounds, no positioning. All right, so it's not a breathing issue. Skin was pink. So I'm like, all right, now let's go down to all the things that can cause an altered mental status. And it focuses down to find out that this 2-year-old was hypoglycemic due to an overdose of alcohol that grandma left her rum and coke on the table.
Classic, classic.
But it helps so much, because otherwise, you know, when I didn't have that tool and I would have a similar patient, it's like you kind of just lock up for a second.
And it's, you know, it's such a simple, you know, it obeys the KISS principle, but it's such a simple thing that I even teach parents about general appearance. When they ask me, how do I know when I need to come to the ER with my child? I tell them about general appearance. And, you know, that's the cutoff. If the child's general appearance is good, well, probably call your pediatrician. But if the general appearance is bad, then that's when you need to be headed toward the emergency department. Simple as that.
Absolutely. I think the hardest population out there is those under the age of 2 months. They just really, I mean, eat, sleep, and poop. That's about it.
Yep. And cry.
And cry, yeah.
And pee.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they do
pretty much five things.
Any pearls in assessing that age group?
The interaction between the baby and the usual caregivers. Even a 2-month-old should respond to the mother, probably even a little bit more than the father, but very early on the instinct is to develop a bond between the young baby and the mom. And that means eye contact, that means responding to the mom's voice, to the mom's touch. You'd be really surprised how much kids, even that little, interact with the mom. So if you have a 2-month-old, now a 2-month-old is not going to have stranger anxiety. So they don't care if mom's carrying them or somebody that they don't know is carrying them, but they really should have some kind of ability to attend to the people that they're used to as their caregivers, but particularly the mom if she's in the picture.
Now, a lot of times I've heard the phrase before, well, he's sleeping, he's tired, he's been crying. And my understanding is that's not always an accurate assessment, that a child really shouldn't be sleeping through an exam or an assessment.
Under certain circumstances, it's true. And particularly in the littler babies, yeah, they can sleep through assessments. And it depends, have they been sick all night and they didn't sleep all night? Maybe they're just for some reason at that moment comfortable enough or just tired enough that they're sleeping. But yeah, that's one of the things that you have to assume, that if there's not any kind of a response during your exam, you have to assume that it is something more serious rather than just assuming that it's, he's just tired. So in that case, then you also have to go back to the caregivers and say, is it unusual for him to be sleeping at this time of the day? Has he been waking up for his feeds the way he usually does? And it's that pattern of sleeping and waking and the habits of feeding and sleeping and waking that you won't get from the child themselves, but from the usual caregivers, that are going to be crucial parts of your history. Because if there's a change in pattern, that's what you've got to be looking at.
We actually, I have a friend of mine that actually had a baby fall off a high chair and smack his head. No, lost consciousness. But he kept saying, well, you know, we didn't do much of an assessment because he was sleeping. And that's kind of what brought that up. I'm like, that seems a little unusual for me,
mm-hmm.
you know, on that. Now, as we leave the 2-month-old, now really the 2-month-old and younger, that's where we start to get worried about infections and fevers with this age group.
Well, first of all, let's distinguish between fever and infection. Okay, infection is disease. Fever is not disease. Fever is a symptom, and therefore it needs to be treated like every other symptom, like a runny nose, like a cough, like vomiting, like diarrhea. It in itself is not a dangerous thing. The misperceptions out there and the misunderstanding and mythology about fever is that fever in itself is harmful. But other than being a causative agent for febrile seizures, which in themselves generally are not harmful to the patient, fever in itself does not cause brain damage until the body temperature gets to be above about 107 degrees, which in children with normal brains, the body temperature control is in the hypothalamus. And if the hypothalamus is normal, then the body temperature shouldn't get above 107 degrees because of fever with infection. So let's separate out the fever from the infection itself.
We're going to break away from the PDU podcast just for a second for a special message.
Hello, this is Kyle David Bates from the First Few Moments podcast.
And I'm Justin Shore, the Happy Medic.
October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month. Many of us have been touched by this disease, both personally and professionally. So I want you to take a few minutes just to think pink.
And after you've done thinking pink, I need you to act pink. We want you to change your website background to pink. We want you to change your avatar on Facebook to pink. We want you to change your avatar on Twitter to pink. But mainly we want to change your attitude to pink. Learn more about your family history and what cancers may affect you, not just breast cancer, but prostate cancer, bladder cancer. Learn the risk factors. Find out if you're at risk and learn more about it. You can learn more about EMS for the cure at pinkwormdry.com and find resources for changing your look at chroniclesofems.com.
Now back to the PDU podcast with Dr. Lou Romig.
When you have fever in a child less than 2 to 3 months of age, it's not the fever that's dangerous. It's just that the fever signals that there is an infection. And children at that age can't really fight off particularly bacterial infections by themselves. So generally less than about 3 months of age, if the children have a documented fever, then they must get to urgent evaluation. So it's not the fever, it's the fever's signal of the infection.
Now, what would you consider for that age group a fever to be worried about?
Okay, well, classically, fever in that age group is 100.4 or greater in a rectal temperature. Okay, and at that age, rectal temperature is really the only accurate way to go. Axillary is not accurate enough. Tympanic thermometers, the ear thermometers, are not accurate at that age. And, you know, some of the other, the God forbid, the pacifier thermometer be used. So 100.4 or greater is a fever. So the big question is just, is there not fever? Not necessarily the degree of fever, because except with very few infections, the degree of fever really doesn't make that much difference.
No, I see, you know, we're coming into that time of year, you know, we're going to start seeing increased illnesses and such on that. We're going to start to see more and more fevers with that. As our population gets older, what fever are we looking at there that we have to be worried about? Because we get called all the time just to say, my kid's got a fever.
It really doesn't matter. And this is something people don't understand. The degree of fever means very little. Again, it's just the fact that is there or is there not fever? Because, you know, you can have a kid with 101 temperature who looks really, really cruddy and who is deathly ill, and have a 2-year-old with a 106 fever who's flying around the hallways and threatening to, you know, to tear the house down. So the degree of fever really means very little.
So really, we're going back and looking at our general impression of the child. Does he look sick or does he not look sick?
Exactly. And one of the best questions is, anybody's allowed to look droopy, hypoactive, have a poor appetite when their temperature is up. But the question is, how do they look when the temperature comes down? Do they perk up? Is their appetite a little better? Are they less fussy? There's general appearance again. If the temperature goes down, but the kid still looks as sick as what he did with the temperature up, that's a reason to worry.
Now, what are some key tips in terms of assessing appearance on child? And we'll go above 2 months of age. We'll get out of that group for a little bit. But, you know, as we get older, what are some key things we want to look at?
Well, once you get past about 6 months of age, until they're maybe about a year and a half or so, depending on how they're socialized, then the children are going to have stranger anxiety. So they're going to react differently to us than they would react to the parents and the caregivers that they're used to. So let's say an eight-month-old who really doesn't care if he's being handed off to you from somebody that he can, that you know that he knows, you're a stranger to him, and he doesn't raise a stink. That's something to be concerned about, because at that age they're supposed to be concerned about strangers. They're supposed to not want to be handed off to somebody that they don't know, and they should be fighting and become kind of anxious and scared. So that would be something to worry about in the 6 month to about a year to year and a half age group.
Do you find – now, your hospital is an urban hospital, correct?
Suburban.
Suburban. Okay. I worked in the city of Buffalo for a while, and, you know, I teach a lot of pediatrics, and I always had that, you know, that stranger anxiety thing. And it was in the inner city I found that it wasn't so common, that a lot of these kids who should be afraid of me weren't.
I was just about to say the exact same thing, because I see that too all the time.
And you know, go ahead, Scott.
No, I was just going to say, I'm sorry to cut you off, but
no, please.
You encounter situations where the kid is raised basically by the community. We have a lot of young parents who end up handing their kids off, and you know, just I find a lot of kids at that age to be very comfortable with just being kind of scooped up with whoever. And that just seems to be, you know, it seems to be a lot more prevalent in an urban setting than what we see in a suburban or, you know, the other settings that I've had a chance to work in.
That's an interesting observation, and it does point out how the social environment influences behavior, because stranger anxiety it's an instinctive kind of thing. It's built in, it's programmed in as a defense mechanism. But if the environment says that, you know, there's a large group of people that I should trust if I'm the baby, then if you don't trust those people, then you cause problems among the group. So then that's an adjustment to the ingrained developmental pattern that adjusts and creates harmony within the group that's supposed to be taking care of the kids. So that's a really kind of cool observation that I hadn't experienced.
It's actually kind of the nurture versus nature aspect. And we actually did it with my son. I didn't pass any IRB, but people would be like, "Ooh, can we see him?" Like, absolutely. And he didn't really have that separation anxiety. He's more shy now when he wants to be. But yeah, we didn't, you know, I really think it came down to nurture versus nature in that. And it was just a fluke thing. I started noticing it. And the one thing I learned about that was when I started to see something that was abnormal is I turned to the parent and I said, "Is this normal?"
There you go.
Do you think that a lot of us really don't spend enough time asking that question?
Absolutely. We cannot overemphasize how important it is to view the caregivers of children. And we're not just talking about parents, but we're talking about extended family members, daycare workers, babysitters, etc. Can't overemphasize how important it is to enlist them as members of the medical care team, because we can't know their child as well as they know their child. And until that kid is old enough to be able to give us good information, him or herself, then they are our informants. And not only do we rely on them to be able to give us information about what's normal and abnormal for this particular child, but it's also important to have them around and have them as part of the patient care team, because number one, the patient is going to want them to be there. And number two, eventually they're going to have to take over all care of this kid again. So you want them enlisted, you want them enrolled, and you want them active. And, we're just not going to be able to take care of kids in a vacuum. We've got to bring those guardians into the picture, use them effectively, allow them to play their very, very important role with the child, and then empower them to take over that child's care once again.
Do you think there's a lot of, or actually, let me rephrase that. How does culture come into play in the caring for children?
Well, culture is really, really important. And, I think everybody here on the call is from the Northeast, and I don't know how culturally diverse your patient populations are, but certainly there is a skew of culture down here in South Florida that's primarily Hispanic, and you can look at the family values of the various cultures and how they view children, how they view caregiving roles, and really you have to put that into your consideration of the interactions between the caregivers and the child and the caregivers and medical providers and the kids and medical providers. The Hispanic culture is very, very protective. Although the men like to think they're in charge, it's really the women that are in charge, and I don't think I'm revealing any secrets there. And a lot of times it's the parents and the caregivers that set the tone for the call. And if the tone that they set is one that's a little bit more on the highly emotional side, then the caregivers are going to have to deal with that level of emotion and try to be able to calm it down, focus it, and not rise to that level of emotion themselves, because then things just escalate from there. So you have to know the cultures that you work with the most commonly, know what their traditions and standards are for dealing with children and for dealing with strangers who are around their children, and be prepared to steer those cultural values in such a way that you can use those traditions and those characteristics to best help the entire medical care team, which includes the family and the child.
I think that's, you know, that's excellent. I think the other thing is, though, and when you come in the cultural aspects of children, in our culture here in Western civilization, we put the child at the top of the ladder. I mean, they are a number one. I think that's one of the reasons why we get so nervous taking care of them, because, oh my God, this child dies. And Scott, you kind of hit it on the head a little bit there, but that, you know, this child hasn't lived their life. But if you go over to like Eastern culture and you go over to other societies and cultures, the child is actually at the bottom of the rung, and you have the elder at the top. You know, they built our society. They gave us life, and they, you know, established a life for us to be in now. And nowhere was this seen more that when I went down to one of our Native American Indian reservations, you know, it says respect your elders is number one, you know, on that. And I think that's something that also probably keep in the mind, you know, with that. I don't know, you know, Dr. Liu down there, if you've seen that with how parents react to certain bad situations with children.
Not so much here. Even though there is a very strong cultural respect toward the elders, really the kids are at the top of the pile. But I know what you're saying about the Native American, some of the Native American cultures. I was made aware of that when I was doing an EPC course for some Native American EMS providers, and we were talking about multi-casualty incidents and how in many, many places in the world, the women and the children go first, that they're at the top of the list to be saved. And I was informed that in many of the Native American cultures, the thing is that you always save the elders first because they cannot be replaced. Children can be replaced, but the elders are irreplaceable. So, you know, it just goes to show that you have to do a little bit of investigation and research into the values of the cultures that you deal with most commonly. And obviously that's going to be different from Miami than it is to New York and you know, Milwaukee and different places. So culture just really, I think, is unrecognized, particularly in EMS, in its impact. And that's another reason why NAEMT and the EPC course has really started leaning on family-centered care and the principles of family-centered care, which are strongly grounded in cultural diversity and being able to adapt to the culture and to the values of those that you're caring for.
I think they kind of covered a little bit about my question I was going to ask you next is, how as providers do we address that? I mean, you know, I've been taught, you know, take care of the kid, take care of the kid, take care of the kid. And, you know, if we have a car accident with several different people in there, they may be telling me, no, take care of my father, take care of my father. How do we address that? How do we deal with that?
Well, first of all, you need to make sure that the value of those issues are recognized by the EMS providers. And when I say EMS providers, I mean everything from an organizational level on down to the individual provider level. And as much as we can teach individual providers about family-centered care and cultural diversity and the values of respecting culture, and unless it becomes an ingrained part of the culture of the EMS agency itself, then it's going to be very difficult to change and to adapt to the cultures that, that you encounter. So that's the first obstacle is getting it into EMS culture itself. I think we've done a fair amount of that, incorporating it into the hospital setting where we've been. Pediatrics have been looking at family-centered care for a long time, but it's a struggle getting it into EMS where, you know, change is not necessarily the easiest thing to have happen. But it needs to be recognized as an essential part of our obligation to the patients and to their families. And I think that's the biggest obstacle right there.
Charlotte, as a resident nurse, what's your feeling in terms of family-centered care?
I think that's the way it should be. And I do agree with the doc that EMS totally gets no training on cultural diversity and understanding that we can't take our cultural beliefs to every call we go to if we're serving a diverse culture, you know, cultural society. We have to be aware of and listen to them, that we're the people that we're taking care of and the families and situations that we're in. I know in the hospital we are very aware of that. We pay attention to who's coming into the emergency room. We watch how they interact. Sometimes there's that, and on the EMS aspect, sometimes there's not that time. You're trying to deal with the here and now and take care of the situation that's at hand, where you may not have time to really take in account the cultural diversity that's in front of you.
I think you find a lot of that also in terms of religious beliefs.
True.
You know, I'm familiar with a story where I believe it was a young child was bleeding and they had to give him a blood transfusion. I believe it was Jehovah's Witness.
Yes.
On there. And, you know, I remember people saying, well, we're just going to give it to him anyways. You know, what's the worst thing I'm going to do? I can get sued or go to jail. You know, where do you cross that? You know, I hear that a lot. Where's that crossing the line?
It's a little different when you're talking about children as opposed to patients who are legally competent to make their own decisions, because then, you know, we've been given the legal obligation to be the advocates for the patient and to assume that the patient would want us to do everything that we could to assure their, you know, their best welfare. When it comes to a kid, gosh, you know, there comes a time, and it's very hard to get to the realization of that time when you just have to say that society is going to have to take over because the parents or the caregivers are not making reasonable ethical decisions. It, you know, you can make all kinds of arguments and be ethically correct when somebody who is capable of making their own decisions says, okay, I don't want this treatment. But when it's someone who can't make their own decision, boy, that's a really, really tough place to have to put your foot down. And, you know, I've been fortunate. There have been very few times when I've had to say, okay, I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to take over and you know, no longer permit you at this particular point to take that action, which may be harmful to your child. But every time I've had to even make that threat, it's been, you know, a real heart-wrenching sort of mental debate as to whether we had gotten to that point or not.
Scott, have you ever had a situation like that or come close to that?
Not with a child. I have with an adult, though. Again, Jehovah's Witness situation, but luckily, I mean, the closest that I've really ever come to that is we had a terminally ill child with a DNR, and the crew was very reluctant and felt that even though that this was a very sick child, had a tough time just kind of looking at this child who had just expired and had a tough time not doing anything for her.
Did they honor the DNR?
They did. But like, you know, they had a tough time with it. I mean, you know, one of them was a mother and it was very hard for her to leave that child and not do anything. And it took a little bit of convincing to reassure her that it was the right thing and that the primary concern at that point should be mom and dad and making sure that that they're okay.
Mm-hmm. Now, recently I had an event where we actually had a child struck by a car, and it was obvious, unfortunately, due to the head traumas, an obvious death on them. And it was difficult to leave, you know, to leave them, but there was nothing that was going to be done. But I all too often I see providers work in these pediatrics and traumatic arrest, and I'm not talking like, you know, just something subtle. I'm talking, you know, massive trauma arrest, or even, you know, SIDS cases that have been down in New York State. And just to give you a brief idea, is unless that kid is stiff with rigor mortis or decapitated, they want us to work it. Where when I was up in Maine. Maine's protocol actually stated in there that, you know, if this child is dead, you know, with no chance of resuscitation, you know, there's a little bit more to that protocol than that. But I always found that interesting on that. And when I teach SIDS lecture, people have a hard time letting go, even if the kid's dead, letting go. Why do we do that?
One of the perceptions is that it's better for the family to see that everything possible was done for the child. That's what everybody says. At least we've given them any possible chance. And the literature, particularly among the SIDS population, the families who have had children who are victims of SIDS, actually the literature is showing that doing that kind of a show code really isn't that big a help to the family, and that many times simply treating the child with dignity and allowing them to die with dignity and to not create false hope is the preference of many of these family members. And we're talking about SIDS parents, you know, kids who are apparently healthy, not with, you know, chronic long-term diseases and known DNRs. But, you know, the SIDS parents say, I respect the fact that they treated my child with dignity and you know, they told me that my child was dead and they didn't give me any false hope. So I think there's a lot of lack of awareness of that kind of literature that's out there. But again, we all, I think, our instinct is to be the advocate for the child and to save as many children in particular as we possibly can. And it's hard to go against that instinct of doing whatever we can for a child. And, you know, sometimes I think people think I'm strange as a pediatrician because I advocate doing less for children a lot of times rather than doing more. And there are many times when children are brought in by EMS and they're being worked, their full codes on the way in. And I pre-establish with my crew, you know, in the ER, how far we're going to go. And if this and this criteria have been met, then that's it. We're calling it. We're not going to work it any further. And that's simply because I know I've been there and I've seen that those efforts, the overwhelming majority of the times are fruitless. And I'm going to do a lot better dealing with the family than I am trying to resuscitate a child who is dead and who's going to stay that way.
How much do you think, especially in terms of the EMS side, is that we're not working it for the family, but subconsciously we're working it for ourselves?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I did everything that I could. I tried everything that I could. I did everything that I've been taught. And I know when I do the lecture, I said, if you're going to work it, make sure you're working for the patient, not for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing I always get back from people is, well, we're not grief counselors. And I don't think it's all that hard to really learn the basic principles of grief.
No, it's not that hard. It's hard to reconcile them as they relate to yourself and your duty. And there is that thought that EMS providers should not be declaring death in the field. You know, except in cases of obvious death, because they can't provide grief counseling to the folks who are left. And I think that is a deficit in education among EMS providers, is some of that basic education about death and dying and the reactions of all the parties involved, from the caregivers and the family members on through the care providers being the EMS people. So I think we really have to go a long way toward further educating our EMS providers about those aspects. And when they get that education and when they get the information that says that, contrary to working an adult in cardiac arrest, the chances of getting a functional survival on a child in full cardiac arrest are vanishingly small, although they seem to be increasing at this point. So there has to be the recognition that no matter how much you do, many times when you're working in a child with arrest, indeed the vast majority of the time, no matter how well or how poorly you do, the child is not going to make it. And therefore, you're not the one that's responsible for their death. It's the process that, you know, injured them or made them ill that's responsible for their death. And, you know, whatever chance you were able to give them, you did. But, you know, you have to be realistic about what those chances are.
I think that there's a lot of pressure put on us, though, in those kinds of situations. When you walk into those scenes and you have the parents looking at you, and in addition to that, you have your colleagues looking at you, you have the fire department looking at you and the police department looking at you, and everybody's saying, do something. The expectation is that you're going to do something. You're not just going to say, nope, I'm sorry, there's nothing that I can do. And I think that that weight falls very heavy on people's shoulders, because in addition to, you know, the acceptance from the parents that everything was done, or the perception to the parents that everything was done, I think that there's also the perception within the culture that everything was done, and within our little public safety niche that everything was done, because you know we might be a little bit more informed than those around us.
And we could even now slide into that debate about the public perception of EMS and our capabilities based on what people see on TV. There's that whole debate there. You know, Rescue 911 many years ago never showed a patient who actually died until several years on into their run. And, you know, all the medical shows will show miraculous recoveries of patients and huge saves that probably would never have happened in the field in real life. So there are unrealistic expectations that are out there, and certainly the popular media has not really helped that.
No, it's just the media, but it's also, I think, the educational process. The PEP course, for example, this has always been my criticism, is the only kids that die in that course are the kids that are talked about in the SIDS lecture.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, are we also giving, you know, false hope in the way we teach?
I think so. Yeah, absolutely. When they talk about cardiac arrest in almost any kind of a course, you know, there's some kind of mention about salvageability rates, but there's not really the emphasis on no matter how hard you try, there's a very good chance you're going to lose them anyway. And that is, you know, that's a reality check there. And, you know, it's not really brought up, because I guess we always want to engender hope and empowerment. But then, you know, then when you don't have a good outcome, then you kind of blame yourself if you didn't know that. Chances are, no matter, you know, you had Dr. Kildare and all the best doctors in the world, nobody was going to save that child. And that's the reality of the situation. And we refuse to face that sometimes.
I think that's kind of that. Scott, go ahead.
I'm sorry. That's interesting. Just from the education side of things, when you think about that, is when you sit there and you run a station with somebody, you run a code station with them, and the patient dies, and there's nothing that the person does that changes that per se. When you're early on in somebody's education, I feel that that's a very important step to take, because the first reaction that you get from somebody is, well, they didn't make it. What did I do wrong? And nothing. You know, your thought process was there, the education was there, and people just need to realize that, you know, one of the first things that people need to understand in EMS is people die. And I think that that's very well taught in the adult side of things, but I think that we kind of fall short when it comes to the pediatric side of things.
But I think if you do that, you also have to be prepared to deal with the aftermath. I mean, it's going to stress people out. You know, there is some potential for some traumatic stress after that, even though it was only simulated. It still kind of brings on to them. So you need to sit and be able to debrief them, you know, afterwards, and let them know that, hey, you know, this was set up, this patient was going to die, and here's why, and you did everything right. So you need to be able to address that as well.
I find it interesting, Scott, that you say that you think that that's dealt with in the adult reference fairly well, when I can't remember ever having a scenario or hearing of somebody offering a scenario like that. And I think that's really an excellent point, that, you know, we can't let them save every person in training. In education, we may be contributing to that. No, we are contributing to that. There's no maybe about it.
Now, Dr. Lu, in the pre-show discussion, I said that kids, they're not scary. And you actually brought up another side of it. Sometimes they are. Can you expand upon that a little bit?
Well, I think the most scary part about kids is number one, the fact that they can't tell you in words what they're feeling, how they're feeling. So that's scary when we're used to being able to get a lot of information directly from the patients. So we have to rely on our other senses to be able to give us that information. And, you know, I mentioned listening with your eyes, because a lot of what you can do with children is really visual assessment and visual diagnosis. The other thing that's scary about them is they can change so darn fast. Kids just in general start out with relatively good protoplasm and physiology, and they can compensate really, really well up into a certain point, and then they just crash and burn. You know, they don't dwindle dead. They really kind of drop dead at a certain point. And the whole key is being able to recognize, I use an analogy, and I have to say that I borrow it from Bob Luton, who is one of the fathers of pediatric EMS. But he tells a story of a kid who's running toward the edge of a cliff, and kids have been falling off that cliff for a long time. So the community at the base of the cliff was debating what to do about it. And there's one group of people that said, well, we should put nets at the bottom of the cliff and people will, you know, get caught on the nets. And then one group that said, no, we need to build a fence at the edge of the cliff so people won't fall off in the first place. And I use that analogy a lot to say, really, you know, kids can always run faster than we can. So we got to make sure that we can see it when they're starting to make that run toward the edge of the cliff, and that we get to the edge of the cliff before they do and keep them from falling off. So one of the really big kids, parts of assessment is being able to recognize those kids who are looking like they're working their way toward decompensation. And when they decompensate, they're off the edge of that cliff. And we're going to save a lot more lives by keeping them from going off that cliff than trying to stand there at the bottom and catching them. So the real key is being able to recognize not just the pre-arrest state, but the pre-arrest state, those kids who are at risk for starting to have the lack of ability for their bodies to compensate for the insult, and being right there to take over before they start decompensating.
I think that's actually fantastic. And actually with that, I think we are going to wrap up this episode of the PDU podcast. Right on that note, I think that may be one of our next episodes coming up here is the pre-arrest, the pre-arrest child for that. So, you know, I want to say thank you to everyone. I want to say thank you to my panel today. I want to say thank you for tuning in to the PDU podcast. We hope that this is going to become a good tool for not only students, but for veteran EMS providers out there, and use the whole site. We're going to actually take the whole site and turn it into an educational site and reference area for you, so that you can go there and learn more about children and the care of pediatrics. So, Scott, where can we find you?
Kyle, you can find me on Twitter at MedicSBK, and at my blog, EMS in the New Decade, at 2010ems.blogspot.com.
Great. Thank you so much for coming on. Charlotte, where can we find you?
Well, I'm easy. Just my email, which is ccrawford@lakeplains.org.
And Dr. Lou Romig, thank you so much for taking time out of your day to be with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I'm looking forward to future podcasts.
This is going to be, I think, a lot of fun. I think we have some really great information to present. And where can our listeners find you?
Well, I have a website. It's www.jumpstarttriage.com. That's one of my other hats is disaster response and multi-casualty triage, the Jumpstart Triage tool. So www.jumpstarttriage.com. All of my lectures, including pediatric assessment lectures, are available for free download from that website. And you can email me either through the website or directly at Lou Romig. That's LOU@bellsouth.net.
Excellent. So glad to have you. And, of course, I'm Kyle David Bates. You can find me on Twitter at ImageMedic. You can find me at KyleDavidBates.com. And you can also find me here at PDU.com. And, take some time. Learn about kids, because really, you know, they're not all that scary of children. I think you'll be okay, and it'll be a good start to improve the care of your kids and not be so petrified when you hear that call come out. So once again, thank you very much for tuning into the Pediatric University Podcast. Have a good day. Oh, no.
to you as long as I can.